The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. The issue before this court is A-19-2068, State of Minnesota versus Thomas Joseph Incantalupo.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is our third oral argument. We're hearing on October 8th, 2020 via zoom.gov. Let me just go over couple of things. Our rules are really very similar to those in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You'll notice that there's a timer. The screen, I think, will get a little larger in one of the little boxes, so that'll help us all keep track of your time. I would ask you to introduce yourself when you begin your arguments, because we have tape recordings of this that we make available on our website. So with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Kevin Rich and I represent the appellant in this matter. This appeal centers on two fundamental principles of our sentencing system. The first is what facts and factors are available to the court when it pronounces a sentence. And especially when the court determines that it's going to depart upward, what it uses to support an upward departure. And secondly, whether or not a defendant's sentence is comparable and proportionate and consistent with the sentences received by similarly situated defendants. In this case, the court explicitly stated that it was relying on an impermissible factor in explaining why it was departing upward, and the appellant sentence is not comparable and consistent with the sentences received by similarly situated defendants. We outlined in our brief the district court's reference to impermissible sentencing factors during its sentencing colloquy. Specifically, the
Mr.
court.
Rich?
Yes.
Could I ask you a bit of a preliminary question? Sorry to interrupt you, but since the parties seem to agree and it's not in dispute because your client admitted to a sentencing departure factor, my question has to do with our standard of review. And perhaps you can point to case law that might help me. Typically, if there's a question of whether a factor is appropriate, it might be a de novo review, but since both parties concede that there was a proper departure factor present, are we not then simply looking at an abuse of discretion as to the sentence imposed as opposed to de novo?
Sure, Your Honor. First of all, the district court's decision to use a specific factor and the availability of a specific factor is a de novo issue. How the court applies that factor is an abuse of discretion. The parties did agree that there was an aggravating factor here, and the appellant pled guilty to the offenses that he pled guilty to, and he stipulated to one aggravating factor. There was an additional aggravating factor that wasn't available to the court, and I think when the Court of Appeals is looking at the propriety of reference to and use of that second aggravating factor, which was the victim's age, and I'll walk through that analysis in just a second. That's a de novo question. The court doesn't have discretion to use unavailable aggravating factors. And I'm gonna jump ahead to a point I was gonna make because I think it's relevant to answer your question, a point I was gonna make later in my argument. And that's if the appellant had received a sentence in this case that was proportionate and comparable, I think the discussion of whether or not the court referenced and relied on an impermissible factor would be essentially an academic one. But because we have a situation where the sentence was disproportionate, there is an interplay between the district court's use of an impermissible factor and the sentence that was ultimately imposed that I think it's important for the court to consider and to walk through that analysis as it's making its decision about what to do in this case. Did that address the question, Your Honor?
I believe it did. I appreciate that. Although perhaps it leads into the second question. Then, if and I'm referring to the actual statement of the court after making reference to the what you refer to improper factors. The court says, but I am basing my departure on the one admitted, and that is multiple forms of penetration. So how do we, how could we rule that was an error when the court's explicitly telling us that the court is relying on the admissible factor, which your client admitted to?
And I think that the court's reference to the relationship of trust between the victim and appellant, and its reference to the what it viewed as the appellant's lack of remorse, there's no evidence other than the discussion of those in the colloquy that the court relied on those in departing upwards. And we don't contend that he improperly relied on those two factors. I think the reference to those factors in the sentencing colloquy is relevant to the second issue, again, of what the proportionality of the sentence that was imposed. But I think the record does reflect that when the court explained why it was departing upward, it stated it was relying on the factor of multiple penetration that was admitted by the appellant. But it also said that the age of the victim at the time of the crime makes that aggravating factor more serious, which indicates that the severity of the offense and the length of the upward departure was based at least in part on the court's consideration of the victim's age, which isn't an available factor because it's incorporated already into the statute of conviction. And so to
rely on- I have a question in that regard. Doesn't the Johnson case, State v. Johnson, suggest otherwise though? In that case, the court did consider the age in a criminal sexual conduct case in determining whether an upward departure was appropriate.
Well, in this case, the statute itself incorporates the victim's age and the culpability of the defendant, and the ultimate sentence calculations, those performed by the Sentencing Guideline Commission and what's the basis for the baseline for the sentence in this case, all reflect the victim's age already. So using
the that's for the underlying offense, not for the upward departure. And I think and I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that that the statute at issue in the Johnson case also did, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I will definitely address this issue on rebuttal, Your Honor. And my understanding of the case law is that age cannot be used. If age is incorporated into the elements of a sentence, that factor cannot be used to justify any length of time imposed in the sentence, because that'd be essentially double counting. That is the severity of the age.
But why isn't it appropriate to consider multiple penetrations, the effect on the victim, and certainly age is relevant to the effect on the victim in considering whether the crime is more serious?
Again, it would go back to that principle that...
Well, yeah, if you could address it on rebuttal, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Will do, Your Honor. Will do, Your Honor. So getting back to the issue of the impermissible factors, the court's statement that it was taking the victim's age into account, we contend is essentially double counting and should not have been relied upon. All this discussion of impermissible factors, though, is really relevant, I think, because it reflects the district court's mindset when it imposed the sentence. And we cited in our brief many cases. I think we cited 8 cases where a defendant received the same sentence as appellant, but there were more aggravating factors, there were more counts of conviction, or there were more incidents of misconduct involved. We cited 6 cases where there was a lower sentence imposed, where there were more incidents and more aggravating factors. We cited 6 cases where there was an upward departure greater than than what appellant received in this case. But which when you look at the conduct in the case and compare that to the severity of the upward departure, is further support for our position that the sentence here was not consistent and not comparable to those cases.
Counsel, what cases do you think are most comparable in terms of sentence?
Well, I think the issue here is...
I mean, you cite cases where there was a, you know, a longer sentence or the same sentence but different facts. Which case is most similar to this one? Because isn't that, you know, which cases are most similar? Because isn't that what we should really be looking at?
And to be frank with the court, I tried to find a case that was where there was two counts of conviction like we had here with the first and a third degree count, and there was one instance of multiple incidents or one aggravating factor, the multiple instances of penetration. I couldn't find a case like that that we could analogize to directly. But I think when you compare what sentence appellant received to the conduct, I mean, that's kind of the point of what we're trying to point out in our brief, is that there are sentences where defendants have received, or cases where defendants have received the same sentence as appellant, but the facts are, and the misconduct is more extensive than what was pled to in this case. And that alone highlights the fact that the sentence is not comparable. That the appellant should have received a lower sentence than he did if it was going to be consistent with cases where defendants have engaged in greater misconduct in terms of the number of incidents, number of victims, number of counts of conviction, number of aggravating factors, but received the same sentence. And I don't believe the state...
Mr. Yuck, just to clarify again, at this point, are you referring to the discretion the court has to do consecutive sentencing, permissive consecutive, which exists here? Or are you referring maybe in the answer to my earlier question that in looking backwards, we look at the length of the departure to determine whether the court used improper factors? And that's perhaps why I'm a little unsure of our standard of review, because if you concede that there was an aggravating factor, which you do, would that in and of itself not take us out of the, does take us out of a de novo and instead simply a discretion? And then secondly, would it not be true that perhaps some of that other information referenced by the court, though it's not appropriate for aggravating departure, might be appropriate for a permissive consecutive sentence?
I think there are, with respect to the two issues, whether or not the court could rely on age as an aggravating factor is a de novo question for the court. Whether or not the court's ultimate sentence was...
Well, let me just stop here. And I think no one would dispute that, but I thought I understood you to say, based on that statement of the judge, that you, on its face, the judge said specifically, I'm not relying on that, but instead relying on the aggravating factor your client admitted to. So if we start from that standpoint, aren't we now leaving de novo review and considering whether for consecutive purposes or perhaps for the overall sentence, if it exaggerated criminality, whether that information is within the court's discretion?
So the question of whether or not the sentence is proportional and exaggerates the criminality is clearly an abuse of discretion standard that the court can review. Whether or not the court in its colloquy by referencing the age of the victim in justifying its upward departure relied on the age of the victim and whether or not that was appropriate, that's a de novo question. Now, I think it's possible for the court to answer that question yes and still affirm based on whether or not the sentence itself abused discretion. But there are two separate legal issues that we're raising here. And one is a de novo question and one is the abuse of discretion question. And that's the proportionality of the appellant sentence. Just briefly, the cases that the state cited to support its position that appellant sentence was consistent with and comparable to other sentences imposed on similarly situated defendants. As we pointed out in our reply, those cases are an opposite, and I want to draw specific attention to the Lewis case. The facts in that case were different and distinct from this case, but I think more importantly, that case was decided based on the prior criminal sexual conduct sentencing scheme. So the sentence that was imposed in the Lewis case used the old sentencing guidelines, the old system. In our briefing, we referred to cases that were decided using the new system, the system that was developed in the mid-2000s, where the sentencing structure became more significant and more severe. because Lewis is from the old system, it's not comparable to and not really helpful to a discussion of whether or not appellant sentence is consistent with sentences imposed on similarly situated defendants, because it uses a totally different sentencing scheme. And then with respect to the Adell and Benitez case, those cases, as we argued, are factually distinct, and frankly, we think they support our position that the sentence here is disproportionate. With that, I'm gonna stop and reserve my last 40 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Reich. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. Can everyone hear me okay? This court should affirm appellant's sentence because the district court relied on a permissible aggravating factor and acted well within its broad discretion in its departure. In the state's view, central to this decision in this case is the standard of review. Because the district court relied on a legal and permissible basis to depart upward, this court is only reviewing, in the state's view, the resulting sentence for an abuse of discretion. This court should only reverse if the district court was acting so far outside its authority to amount to an abuse of that broad discretion, which is simply not this case. Now, I'd be happy to answer any questions if the panel has any questions to start.
Counsel, can you address the question of age and whether that was appropriately considered in the consideration of the aggravating factor? Excuse me.
It's the state's position that the district court was not relying on age as an aggravating factor. I think when taking into account and reading the entire remarks by the district court judge, it is clear that he is only specifying multiple forms of penetration as the aggravating factor on which he was departing. I think that his description of it seeming serious in this case with a victim of this age is simply him applying the factor to the facts at hand. And so I think that he acknowledges that age is the district court, that age is already an element of the offense. And so I think that that is just the district court describing his view that multiple forms of penetration seemed more serious in a case such as this. And that's not using the element of age as the aggravating factor itself. So that's the state's position, is that that was not being relied upon impermissibly. And so in the state's view, that does land us firmly in simply abuse of discretion as the standard of review for the remaining analysis.
Ms. Volks, does it make your opinion different that the judge also referenced a special relationship? And so you have both age, special relationship. Would you agree that at a minimum, the waters are somewhat significantly muddied when the judge is referencing and talking about the aggravating factors before getting to the one that the appellant actually admitted to? And if that's the case, would that not be a de novo review, at least until we can come to some resolution that in fact the court did not rely upon those other factors?
I think at the outset, as this court reviews the record, obviously, if it's not clear what the aggravating factors are, the court needs to discern that first to determine whether or not we have a de novo issue, a legal problem about what the court is relying upon. And what I will say is that I think that the district court, I suppose, could organize his comments about the case and about the sentencing maybe in a different way to sort of separate out sort of how he characterized the case in general. He was very familiar with this case. Obviously, there was extensive victim impact. There were many hearings. The discovery was voluminous. And so perhaps the district court could have organized his comments to sort of separate out sort of his general description of the case from the specific legal factors. But I do think that regardless of that, the district court specifically says that he knows that he cannot rely upon elements of the offense and that the only factor he is departing upon is a well-established, long-standing factor of multiple forms of penetration. And so if we're going to disregard the district court's sort of explicit statements of what it is he is using to rely upon, I think that that would be a mistake when the district court obviously, I think, tried to make sure that was clear, despite sort of other comments about the case itself.
So, Ms. Brooks, to follow up on that, what part of the sentence would you direct us to that would suggest those comments the judge made were indeed relevant, such that we, number one, would agree with you that there was no error of law in terms of the departure, but also no abuse of discretion in terms of the ultimate sentence length?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Yes. What I'm getting at is, obviously, when we review the records, we are looking at those comments the court made that you say the court did not rely upon and should not rely upon in its departure. But the court nevertheless made those, and as appellant's counsel is asking us to look at the ultimate end sentence, the length, the consecutive nature of it. So what would you point us to in terms of that sentence that would suggest those comments were relevant for purposes of the sentence, but were not used for purposes of the departure itself?
So I'm not entirely sure if I'm understanding your question.
Well, but I'll just suggest it then. Are you agreeing that those statements were completely gratuitous, irrelevant to the sentence ultimately imposed, both with regard to departure and the consecutive nature of the two counts?
I mean, I guess in terms of the narrow legal question, yes, they are irrelevant. I think that the district court, is speaking to the defendant, the attorneys, the victim who's been present. And so I think that the vast majority of those comments aren't really relevant to whether or not the legal departure was permissible. I think that most of his commentary is just describing the case. And I think that, he is clear because he does say things like, I cannot depart on the fact that there's a significant relationship. So although he's saying things that I think are important for everyone in the courtroom to hear, he then goes on to clarify that that's not the ground for the departure.
Would it be reasonable then, that being the case, or support appellant's point that if it's completely gratuitous, that it tends to suggest the court either erred by using it to depart as the amount of the departure and or exaggerating the criminality if the court's making references to irrelevant facts?
Well, I don't think that the court's comments, I wouldn't go so far as to say they're gratuitous. I think what I would say is that they're not relevant to that particular legal inquiry. I think that if the district court's language was highly inflammatory and maybe went on for pages on end, and then we also had a resulting sentence that seemed completely disproportionate, then maybe we'd have an indication that the judge was clearly not just basing it on that factor, but had a whole lot of other information that was maybe tipping the balance. I think here that the commentary, although it doesn't go to that specific question, it was a sentencing hearing, and these comments aren't necessarily gratuitous. They're maybe just not relevant to the narrow question we have here. And so I think that his comments, I think, are measured, and I don't think that there's anything that seems out of the ordinary to suggest that then there was impermissible reasoning going behind the ultimate sentence that was imposed.
Thank you.
Ms. Folks, turning to the second issue regarding whether the sentence was disproportionate, appellant cites a number of cases in appellant's brief to argue that the sentence is disproportionate and exaggerates the criminality of the offense or the offenses. You only cite three cases in your brief. So given that, has appellant established that the sentence is disproportionate?
No,
exaggerates the offenses?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the question really is, do these facts warrant this sentence? And I think the challenge is that a perfect fact-to-fact comparison is not possible. And appellate opinions typically, they vary, but they often might not have the degree of specificity of facts to truly determine if a case is the equivalent of this case. And I would also note that criminal sexual conduct cases are layered and complex, and they vary widely in the ways that offenders violate the victims. Unlike an aggravated robbery, where there may be very simple facts to compare, a broken nose, a broken jaw, I think that these cases are highly complex. And I think that it's important to note that out of the thousands of cases that district courts preside over and the offenders that district courts sentence, only a small percentage of cases are appealed on the basis of the sentence. And so appellate courts only see a particular slice of these cases. And judges have sentencing discretion. And the key here is the sentence that the district court arrived at so far beyond the pale, so far beyond what happens in a typical case with aggravating factors that it exaggerates the criminality of his behavior? Is this sentence not commensurate with his behavior? And I think here, when looking at the vast number of criminal sexual conduct cases with aggravating factors, this case fits into that constellation of criminal sexual conduct cases. There may be cases that are far more serious and have, you know, a greater sentence. I think it's important also to look at the extent of the departure. So one of the cases that I cited, although it was under an old sentencing scheme, the court can still look at how big was the departure to sort of determine whether or not this was proportional. And so I think that the Lewis case is still relevant here. And so in the state's view, this court can look at, like I said, sort of the vast array of results that that happen on these criminal sexual conduct cases and see that it fits in. And that, yes, there are some that are more serious and get greater numbers, that there's going to be some natural variation because judges are different people who are imposing the aggravated sentences. I think that the system as a whole acknowledges that district courts are well suited to determine the appropriate sentence, and that aggravating factors, that whole premise of departures, calls on the district court to say, is this more serious than the normal case that you see day to day? And so implicit is the fact that district court judges are well suited to determine what constitutes a more serious case. And for me, that brings it back to the standard of review here, which is, I think, State versus Dillon is in particularly important the way it sets out the framework that the shorter the departure, the greater the deference, and that departures that are between the presumptive and double the presumptive invite the greatest deference, and that this court generally defers entirely to the district court's judgment. And so when we're in that zone of greatest deference. So here, the fact that there is this wide array of cases, but we can find some that make it seem that this particular sentence does not seem completely disproportionate and exaggerating, but instead fits within that constellation of cases, that it's clear that the district court did not abuse its discretion.
Thank you.
So
anything further?
I'll conclude. Appellant here entered a plea negotiation and he pled guilty to two counts. He admitted the aggravating factor in exchange for dismissal of multiple counts. And based on multiple forms of penetration alone, this district court could have done a double upward departure on the top count, sentencing the appellant to 344 months on that count alone and still remaining within that zone of greatest deference that appellate courts afford. And so because the district court acted well within its broad discretion when it made its decision of whether and how much to depart, the district court did not abuse its discretion. The resulting sentence in no way exaggerates the criminality of appellant's conduct. For this court to reverse would be for this court to substitute its judgment for the judgment of the district court. Respondent respectfully requests this court affirm appellant's sentences. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will turn to you, counsel, for any rebuttal. I think you need to unmute yourself to begin that.
Thank you, Judge. Sorry about that. So the first thing I want to address is the question that related to State versus Johnson during my initial argument. And in Johnson, the district court cited the victim's age as an aggravating factor. On appeal, the state did not rely on that factor and did not argue that it should have been considered. And in fact, the court stated that since the offense contained an age element, it would be unfair in this case to consider that factor again as a departure factor. And even though we have a situation where the judge in this case stated he was relying on the multiple forms of penetration, discussing the age as making that more severe is essentially incorporating age as an additional aggravating factor. That's our position on that issue, and I think it's supported by the record. With respect to
counsel, I read that case a little differently. You're correct that the court said it didn't rely on age, but it did then when it considered the proper aggravating factors, it did take into account age. So age by itself can't be an aggravating factor, but it appears that the court did consider age in considering the other aggravating factors. And also cites the Luna case, which said the combination of these facts with other facts, including the fact that the victim was only 13 years old, and Luna was a CSC case as well, makes this case sufficiently different in degree to justify the limited upward departure.
Understood, Your Honor. I guess I just read that case, the Johnson case, differently as stating specifically that age is not available as an aggravating factor. So in this case—
Well, that's true, but I think this court also didn't rely on age as a specific aggravating factor. It just took it into account in considering the aggravating factor of multiple penetrations.
And our position is, we recognize that that's what the court said, but our position is that is the equivalent of relying on it separately as an aggravating factor. If it ends up adding time to the departure that the court's going to impose, that's the equivalent of relying on it as a separate aggravating factor, which would have been improper under Johnson. I think our argument is in using age to aggravate an aggravating factor, it's essentially using age as an aggravating factor. The impact is the same.
Impact. Mr. Yock, could I follow up on that just a bit? If we, on the first issue, disagreed with you and from a de novo review based on the court's own words, conclude that the departure was not based on an improper factor such as age, and we also know that the sentence itself at a little over 1.5 times the first count, 1.5 times the presumptive is well within, as Ms. Volks indicates, acceptable by our case law. And that was true for the second count as well. Aren't we left then really that in terms of criminality boils down to the court's discretion to do consecutive sentencing on the second count? And if that's the case, would it not be true for consecutive purposes, issues such as age or special relationship, matters such as that which the court did reference, would be important to the court's overall decision to exercise discretion to sentence consecutively and therefore not be an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think I go back to our central position, which is that there are factors that are legally available to the court when it determines the length of a sentence. And if it considers those factors in setting the length of a sentence at any stage in the process of determining its sentence, that's especially in a case where the impermissible factor is an element of the offense and already incorporated in the sentence established by the sentencing guidelines, that's double counting. That's our argument.
And comes special relationship an element of the offense pled to?
Yes. Position of authority is an element of the offense as well.
So, and is there any particular case law? Are you referring to the same case related to aggravating sentence versus consecutive sentences?
There is case law we cited in our brief, Your Honor. I can't recall it off the top of my head, the specific case that relates to relationship of trust as an element of the offense. But just briefly, because I only have a minute left, I just want to speak about the proportionality piece of this case, because I think that's the center of this case. The discussions about the aggravating factors feed into and illuminate, I think, what is the natural tendency in a case like this to rely on facts and factors that are outside the proper scope of consideration for the sentencing court. You could see it in the PSI, which relied on those factors in explaining its recommendation. You could see it in the sentencing arguments that were made to the court. You could see it in the court's discussion of the sentence, even though it expressly disclaimed those facts and factors. You could see it in the state's brief. There's an understandable tendency to look outside what has been pled to and admitted by a defendant in a case like this. And that, I think, is what happened here, which is why we ended up with a sentence that is not comparable or proportionate or consistent with any of the almost a dozen sentences that I could find in my research where a defendant was sentenced for the same kind of offense, even though the facts might have been more extreme. I think my time is up.
Well, the court would like to thank both of you for your helpful arguments and briefing in this matter. We'll take it under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory time period. This is the end of the third and end of our oral arguments this morning. So the court is in recess.